Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today I'm joined by Michelle Schwarzy, who is at University of Wisconsin-Madison. We are approximately 100 miles from each other, but we are talking across the internet. And today we are talking about her book, Recognizing Resentment, Sympathy, Injustice, and Liberal Political Thought. This was published in 2020 by Cambridge University Press, and it is a really interesting discussion and sort of interrogation of this idea of resentment, but I'm going to let Michelle tell us about that. I'd like to welcome Michelle to the New Books Network and ask her to tell us a little bit about herself and how she came to this project. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Lily. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me virtually, even though we're so close in reality, as you mentioned. I'm really excited to chat about the book today. As you mentioned, this is my first book, and as I note in it, it's actually a very, very revised version of my dissertation. So it contains ideas I've been working on for embarrassingly like a decade now or something. Really, it's an effort to try to explore the role of resentment and initially violent passions and strong emotions in political life, and to see when and if it's possible to normatively justify resentment, what positive role, if any, it might play in politics. And so the argument that I make in the book, I take a history of political thought approach and look at some authors in the canon and some authors sort of off to the side, a little less well-known, a little more obscure, who initially developed this idea of sympathetic resentment and a particular kind of sympathetic resentment that I call spectatorial resentment, and show how this really feeling resentment on behalf of other people can play a really important role in supporting justice in liberal societies. And so that's the argument that I try to advance in the book, which I think is one that also has normative and contemporary relevance, despite the fact that all the thinkers in the book are, you know, old dead guys from the 17th and 18th century.
And the old dead guys that you use primarily, in you have three that are primary, and then you have a couple on the side, as you note. Can you talk a little bit about who those three main interlocutors for you are, and you put them in conversation with each other, and also some of the other voices that you bring into that sort of interesting conversation that you've structured from the 18th century?
Yeah, of course. So the reason, the motivation for turning to the three thinkers that I do, and those three thinkers are Bishop Joseph Butler, David Hume, and Adam Smith. So three thinkers really integral in this movement called the Scottish Enlightenment in the 18th century. I turn to these thinkers because I'm really interested in what they have to say about resentment. And they were all writing during the height of this debate about kind of the role of emotions and reason in sociability, or the ability of people to live together well in large, diverse societies, which really starts being, it's discussed throughout the history of political thought, right? What is the best political regime? what should we look for in terms of thinking about what the best way to structure a political society is. But really in the 17th and 18th century, we start to see thinkers deal with strong emotions or passions, as they would have referred to them at the time, and the role that they play in either promoting sociability or in inhibiting it. And so the story that I try to tell in the book is how initially the first chapter is devoted to a lot of these thinkers in the 17th century and a bit in the 18th century, folks like Thomas Hobbes and Baruch Spinoza, some of the natural law theorists like Hugo Grotius, and my favorite, Samuel Pufendorf. My students always love hearing his name, a famous Prussian natural law theorist. And then Bernard Mandeville, an English political theorist, but originally Dutch. And sort of the things that they have to say about how passions contribute to economic and political stability, and how that transitions into this conversation in the 18th century of the really positive role that specifically one strong passion, resentment, can play in getting us to recognize injustice and getting us to try to do something about it. So that's really why I focus on first Butler, then Hume, and then Smith. So Butler is the most obscure of these three thinkers. In fact, usually when I say, oh, I work on Butler, Hume, and Smith, people say, it's really weird to include Judith Butler in this conversation, which, fair enough. And instead, I have to clarify, obviously, that I'm talking about Bishop Butler, who's a really interesting, but admittedly pretty unknown figure in the history of political thought, an Anglican bishop who was incredibly important to the sentimentalist movement, to those thinkers in the 18th century who were interested in grounding moral rules and thinking about politics through the eyes of emotions, through the role that emotions played in political life. And in particular, Butler was one of the first thinkers to not only argue that resentment had a positive role in motivating justice and providing for political stability, but that it was an innocent passion or an innocent moral motive that did so. So that's one way he departs from some of his 17th century and early 18th century predecessors, or in fact contemporaries in the case of Mandeville. So I start by looking at him. He also plants the seeds for this really important concept that's in the subtitle of the book, and that is sympathy, or what we would think of as empathy today, this concept in the 18th century of putting that's developed that we think of as putting ourselves in someone else's shoes and trying to imagine what they go through, that's so important, again, for this debate about sociability. And so Butler sort of sows the seeds of those two concepts that then Hume famously picks up on and also points out some issues with, and really kind of the apex of the book, or the culmination of some of these ideas, come to a head in the chapter on Smith, where you get where I fully describe what spectatorial resentment is, what it means to resent on other people's behalf, how sympathy facilitates that and moderates it in really important ways, as well as sort of what lingering problems might exist. So I'd say one, maybe this is the academic in me, but one thing that's interesting about the book is that it's not totally a positive story, or not totally a happy ending, I suppose, with the role of resentment in political life, but rather a story about exactly the promise that it can hold, but also some of the limitations, like sort of like anything, any more motive that you might think about in politics that exist even with all this promise.
And one of the points that you sort of bring up as you're bringing the thesis forward is the fact that liberalism, classical liberalism, liberalism in its many definitions, and as you also note in a footnote, there are many definitions. And so just to sort of clarify that a little bit, but that liberalism is to be grounded in rationality. And that, you know, the resentment, and as you talk about it throughout the book, sympathy or empathy, we're moving into this role of the passions or the emotions, which are sometimes problematic for our friends who have written about sort of liberalism. Can you explain a little bit about that tension and how these thinkers and then some of the secondary thinkers that you're also talking about are trying to work emotions into liberalism?
Yeah, so there, in the introduction to the book, essentially, I say that I'm trying to get kind of involved in the debate about motivating liberal justice. So one criticism of the rational approach to liberal justice, which says that the way that you can motivate or the way that you can figure out what our duties are to other people in a liberal society, which has sort of minimal political commitments other than this commitment to procuring security for all people, freedom and security for people, that that kind of society might have trouble motivating people to be good citizens or to do their duty in other respects in political life. And so what I try to suggest in the book is that one thing we might turn to, and this is in the vein of a lot of literature that sought to bring the passions back in, like Rebecca Kingston's work on this front, Sharon Krause's work on this front, has sought to find a way that we might incorporate passions as motives for various political duties while sort of moderating their more troublesome or worrisome effects. So if you think of things like anger, you think of things like resentment, you think of things like grief, all these very powerful emotions that can motivate us to do different things, they often have kind of secondary problematic spillover effects. And so if you're concerned with those spillover effects, or moreover, if you're concerned with what the principle is for motivating a particular duty, like we need to be able to motivate a duty to justice or to be just based on a rational principle, as someone like Kant would say, or someone I discuss in the book as well, Martha Nussbaum's recent book on anger and forgiveness sort of argues one of the reasons that resentment is problematic is because it's this immature passion. Even if we didn't worry about the spillover effects, that we would still worry about it as a good motive or universalizable motive for justice. And what I try to address in the book is that these passions, in some cases, can have these either problematic spillover effects, or they can have these problematic spillover effects, but these are in certain circumstances. And one of the benefits in particular of sympathy, of being able to put yourself in other people's shoes and adopt their emotions, is the kind of natural moderation that happens in that process. So the focus of the book is what Stephen Darwall has called second personal resentment, or the resentment that you feel on behalf of another person. And that's this kind of key to being able to give you some perspectival distance and therefore some natural moderation, rather than the anger or resentment that you would feel on your own behalf that traditionally liberals tend to worry a lot about because of either those spillover effects or some of the their concerns with irrationality of emotions.
And so I wanted to ask you to also define this term that you use through the book, and I had to try to say it before I started talking to you, spectatorial resentment. I wanted to make sure that I had all the syllables correct. And I mean, I have a sense, and you explain it in the book, but for people who are listening to this conversation, can you talk a little bit about that? Because you were just sort of leading into it as a second person resentment, and how that works within the sort of context of liberal thought.
Yes, yeah. So to start, when I was talking about second personal resentment, the key that I mentioned, or the key faculty that enables second personal resentment, is sympathy for a lot of these thinkers, or again, what we would consider empathy, the ability to adopt emotions on behalf of another person, or to approximate those emotions. And this can be everything from something as simple as seeing someone else smile and feeling happy by sort of contagion sympathy, is what we usually refer to that as, or something more as complex as adopting a character in a play's grief at the loss of a partner or a child or something like that, based on the information that you know from the story and from spectating and watching the play. So what really Smith does in developing this concept of sympathy, because he's the thinker that really gets you the most comprehensive and complex understanding of sympathy, is he builds on a notion of compassion or pity that was somewhat popularized in the 18th century. Pity we can think of as being especially important to thinkers like Rousseau and some other French political theorists, but says it's not when we feel with other people, it's not just that we feel bad for them, or it's not that we only feel sadness and grief. Instead, sympathy is really much more cognitive. Kind of interesting for someone to say this in the 18th century. There's a lot of contemporary work in psychology and experimental economics that picks up on Smith because of this, but essentially says sympathy can be feeling with other people, you know, on a whole range of emotions, from grief to happiness to anger to resentment, importantly, to gratitude. We can feel a host of emotions with other people. And it's really good for the most part that that can happen, because that allows for us to connect with other people in a way that simple sort of rational interaction might not. It also causes some problems for Smith, most notably. He, and kind of maybe interestingly for your listeners who are less familiar with him, think of him more as the father of modern capitalism. I always tell my students, you know, they think of him as like a monocle wearing capitalist, which is funny because, of course, Wealth of Nations is just a polemic against mercantilism and against monopolies. But that tends to be the caricature of him that we get today. And really, Smith accounts for much of our motivation to sort of push ourselves in commercial society, political ambition, economic ambition, because of this weird quirk with sympathy, which is that we tend to sympathize with the rich and great because we see all their wealth and riches and imagine ourselves in those situations and think of how great it would be. And so it's easier to sympathize with them. And then we try to work to gain the same wealth, even at the expense of our happiness sometimes. So just kind of an interesting side note on the fact that sympathy, despite the fact that it really is going to have enormous beneficial import in terms of social stability, political stability, economic stability, isn't wholly unproblematic for Smith, because of some of these other moral complications. But the story that I try to tell about it is that sympathy allows for us to adopt the resentment that victims of injury feel when they're harmed by other people. And importantly, according to Smith, when we do this, when we go through a sympathetic process and try to come up with moral judgments, we need to think through the situations that they themselves are in, think through the situations of the criminal that harmed them, consider what the injury looked like, whether it actually is an injury rather than a harm, go through this entire process. And if we adopt their sympathy and approve of it, think it is merited, then we actually call for rectification on their behalf. So a number of really important things in that process of sympathetic resentment, which becomes spectatorial resentment when it is done through this moral judgment process that I'll mention more about in just a quick second. But when we engage in sympathetic resentment with other people, we importantly are connected to the victim. We're alive to injustice in liberal societies in ways that we wouldn't be if we simply rationally considered the situation. And because of that push to call for rectification of injustice, once we adopt the resentment of a victim, we actually are motivated to do something about injustice. So sympathetic resentment has this really important potential to connect us to other citizens in liberal societies, to focus us on injustice, and to motivate us to do something about it. All really critical parts of a liberal view of justice and injustice. And I should say, one of the secondary thinkers that I'm perhaps most indebted to in my view of liberalism and what I think is sort of missing from it and what these thinkers can help address is Judith Sklar, who I talk about in the introduction to the book, who really sees the purpose of liberal justice as minimizing cruelty, not simply minimizing harm, as obviously John Stuart Mill would have it, but minimizing the potential for cruelty, which really requires us to take a careful look at misfortunes and bad things that happen in society and consider when those misfortunes might become injustices, that is, when they might become active injuries that we can do something about. And so I think sympathetic resentment allows us to be able to do that thing. One last note, when sympathetic resentment becomes spectatorial resentment, that mouthful term that I use for Smith, is when not only we adopt the resentments of other people, but when we think they are merited or justified. And the process of figuring out how resentments are merited or justified is a particular one for Smith, but a really important one. It's based on what he calls his impartial spectator, or what we call his impartial spectator theory, that says moral standards or norms, how we know something is right or wrong, is based on our not only sympathy with another person, but our imagination and what we think an impartial observer would judge of the circumstances if they were fully informed and if they were able to sympathize with all parties. So it's not just would your friend or would your parent or would someone close to you in your society approve of what you're doing, but would an impartial observer who is fully informed about the circumstances and capable of sympathizing with everyone, would that person approve or disapprove of the circumstances? So it really is Smith's way of explaining how some resentments, in fact, might be unjustified, or how some resentments we might have to drop or consider unmerited based on the judgment of an impartial spectator.
And part of what you're describing are also some of the ways that Socrates sets up. I mean, the way that you're sort of mapping this out is what Socrates sort of sets up in book one of the Republic in terms of these different sort of understandings of justice. Is it just your friend who you feel, you know, sort of sympathetic with, or, you know, can we do that for the whole society? And so I'm seeing echoes, quiet echoes of the various sort of interlocutors that Socrates contends with in book one. I don't know if, I'm sure that was part, possibly you sewed that in. I don't know.
No, that's really interesting. No one has ever brought up the, you know, you're talking about Polemarchus, right? The Polemarchus's view of justice from book one of the Republic, that you do good to your friends and harm to your enemies. And that's what justice consists of. I think it's just a really powerful and intuitive view of justice that thinkers throughout the history of political thought have had to grapple with. And really in the modern era, you see lots of different ways of trying to figure out what impartiality could look like, right? So prior to Smith, you have Locke. That's almost, in my reading and understanding of Locke, right? That's the fundamental question for him. How do you set up an impartial judge who can adjudicate between rights disputes, right? You need some sort of person who doesn't just have their own interests and their own rights in mind, but somebody who would be able to to impartially determine these the outcome, proper outcome of these disputes. And for Smith, and in fact, a lot of sentimentalists, one looming threat in the background is always relativism. So kind of the thing that, Polemarchus isn't relativist, but if you have a moral theory that's based on spectatorship, that you say norms are created by other people's judgments, well, how do you know that you're not just subject to the judgments of a particular time or place or what have you? And so the question of impartiality becomes especially important for sentimentalists in the Scottish Enlightenment. But I think you're right. It's that question about what justice consists of and if it's anything other than just partiality, being partial and doing partial good rather than a general good or an impartial good is a question throughout the history of political theory.
And yeah, I did want to put you on the spot with regard to book one of Plato's Republic, but you know, political theorists always are talking about that. You know, gotta throw it in. But you've talked a lot about Smith, because as you note, Smith is kind of the apex of your theory, and you've talked about Bishop Butler, not Judith Butler, so we're all clear on that one. But you also spend a good chunk of your work on Hume. And he seems to be sort of the transitive property between these two thinkers in the main thinkers that you're looking at. Can you talk about how Hume is the sort of connection between Butler and Smith?
Yeah, of course. Hume is in some ways the most complicated thinker in the book, or his thoughts on resentment are the most complicated and mixed of any thinker in the book. He, like Butler, though actually Hume and Butler famously had some personal disagreements along with Hutcheson. You know, Hume didn't have a lot of friends and advocates other than Adam Smith when it came to Scottish politics and university politics, which is why he never had a position as a professor during his lifetime. But similar to Butler, interestingly enough, given that Butler was an Anglican bishop and Hume is probably the most infamous atheist from the last few hundred years, they both are interested in grounding morality on sort of naturalistic grounds. So Butler will come back and say that this is approved of by God, or this is proof of God's goodness, is that we have these natural capacities that make us moral. But he's fundamentally interested in grounding them in our a kind of naturalistic view of morality. And Hume obviously does a similar thing and is interested in developing that in the Treatise of Human Nature especially. But Hume is also interested fundamentally in his political works and his economic works in stability, right? This is one of the reasons that I think he often gets read, correctly or incorrectly, as a conservative thinker, is that, you know, it's all well and good to have some of the more polite and humane virtues and to have a more extensive liberty, but fundamentally Hume is also concerned about security, right? If you don't have a state where you have some kind of political stability, and importantly, where you can prevent the worst people in power from doing what they want, then you're not going to ever achieve any kind of modicum of political liberty, which is really the story of his six-volume history of England. And so Hume has kind of a mixed relationship with resentment. Famously, his theory of justice is based or considers justice an artificial virtue, which for Hume means that it has no basis in an original motive or natural motive. And yet at the same time, he tells us that all virtues, to be virtues, have to have some natural basis or motive. Otherwise, we wouldn't be motivated to do them, and therefore they couldn't be called virtues. And so it's a bit of a kind of confusing theory, challenging theory to work through, which people have, commentators in the past have often referred to the motivational deficit in Hume's theory of justice. And one thing that I try to do is reconstruct the development behind what I think is really the emotion behind justice for Hume, and that is something he calls the common sense of interest or sense of common interest. This idea that really Russell Hardin has talked about it as social trust, that we feel that other people see the advantage of cooperation, that we can trust them to perform their commitments, and that. But it's not a rational understanding of anything. It's really just that we have to feel that kind of trust for society to work. And so in the chapter, I try to explain what's behind that. And I think importantly for Hume, resentment has a big role to play there. He talks a lot about this in the restatement of parts of book two and book three of the treatment of the Treatise of Human Nature, which is published a little bit later on, called The Enquiry Concerning the Principles of Morals, which actually in Hume's little brief autobiography, he referred to as his best work. He thought it was his best work, interestingly enough, which is not what the scholarly consensus is, I don't think, but it's a fun book to read. So is the 8-page autobiography, My Own Life. That's where he also famously says that the Treatise of Human Nature fell dead-born from the press. So he's got lots of little tidbits about his publication history. But the Enquiry Concerning the Principles of Morals, he really talks about the role of resentment and how it, how when we treat people or when we consider people as objects or subjects of resentment, we really consider them as subjects of justice. So it's almost sort of in line with what Rawls has to say. And of course, Rawls in the 20th century adopts Hume's circumstances of justice, what human beings need to be like to be subjects of justice, that we need to have limited benevolence, that there needs to be some amount of scarcity for justice to be relevant. And I think one thing that Hume also talks about that's important is that when we resent other people, when we recognize that other people are capable of making their resentment have an effect on us, we consider those people subjects of justice. Otherwise, we sort of exclude them as unequals. And when we do that, right, we don't consider them free and equal persons, to use the Rawlsian language, and we don't consider them subjects of justice. So really, resentment reveals kind of both the background behind the emotion, I think, that undergirds justice for Hume, and also it shows a really important thing, and this is what links him to Smith, is the importance of individuals who can adopt each other's resentments, that their status or standing with one another is relatively equal. So one key part of spectatorial resentment that I emphasize in the book that begins with Hume, but again, finds kind of its most full defense in Smith, is this notion that when you adopt someone else's resentments, you are recognizing them as a relative moral or political equal. And that kind of recognition of someone's fundamental equality is really important for liberal societies, that are committed to not only freedom, but equality. So you find that kernel of an idea in Hume with his discussion of resentment that, again, Smith really develops. Another really important thing I think Hume discusses is what we were just talking about, actually, the threat of partiality that Smith ends up addressing through impartial spectator theory. But Hume is famously quite concerned with what he calls our strong love of relations, this idea that people who are closer to us in space or time or social distance, we are just naturally more able to sympathize with, to feel things with, to defend, etc. And that actually that can be a really bad thing for large, diverse societies, right? That kind of partiality can threaten sociability. So again, in his History of England, you find a wealth of examples on that front. Famously, the issues that he sees with factions, political parties, and particular kinds of political parties, but also great rulers and our tendency to follow great rulers. So the third and fourth volume of the History of England talk a lot about this, about sort of the Tudor realm. And prior to that, you have Henry, who's really acting on all of his personal resentments, and you have a court that kind of adopts all of those resentments without any kind of deliberation or reflection, then you can have really, really bad outcomes. So Hume actually explains, I think, what some of the real pitfalls of even sympathetic resentment can be if you don't have some means of identifying which kinds of resentments are good or bad or partial, or, and how you might mitigate those.
So there's a need to be able to sort of sort through the resentments so that they're ones that are legitimate or just and ones that are potentially corrupting or bad or undermining, as you note, the sort of sociability of large, diverse institutions or regimes, societies. And so I wanted to get you to explain a little bit more, because most of us, when we think about the term resentment, it's a negative valence, right? And so what you have argued, and again, the whole time I was reading your book, I had to keep rethinking my idea of what the word means, the word itself means to me, and how I can sort of see it in a positive venue and in a positive way. And I understand the way you're talking about it, but it is kind of pushing a little bit against our usual line of thought. So I would love for you to explain how to rethink, I guess, our understanding of resentment and how it really is, as you argue, can be used for the good of all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. I think that's everyone's initial reaction, right? At least in American culture, that tends to be our reaction, in part because I think we associate resentment with a kind of unreflective anger on our own behalf. So most commonly recently, right, when we think of contemporary American politics and contemporary American political discourse, we talk about grievance politics and racial resentments or rural resentments. My colleague here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Kathy Kramer, wrote a great book on the politics of resentment and sort of Wisconsin politics and the rise of Scott Walker, where she argued that the resentment of, and she doesn't mention whether it's justified or unjustified. Kathy isn't a political theorist. She's she studies American politics. So she tried to figure out what was going on. And she said, really what's happening is people in other parts of the states and rural areas of the states resent the urban centers, especially Madison, where the university is and where the Capitol is, and think that it gets all its resources. So the politics of the state has been characterized by resentment and anger and a rejection, an interest in sort of foiling all of the plans of the urban liberal elite that it thought was taking resources away from it, right? So that's one example of resentment we often talk about in American political discourse today, the racial resentment of the populist right or the Republican Party more broadly, right, and how that might drive white identity politics today. But what I try to do in the book is explain how resentment or indignation against wrongs done, one doesn't need to have a negative or irrational effect. That is, doesn't need to have the connection to, say, violence or punitive actions that are irrational or disproportionate that we often associate with things like rural or racial resentment. And two, that resentment can actually be an appropriate reaction to injury. I think one of the things that we lose when we give in to the idea that all resentment is rural or racial resentment, that it's unthinking or it's unreflective, that it leads to violence, is we forget that there are lots of people in liberal societies that actually do suffer injury right? And or they suffer injustice. And if we don't do anything to try to recognize what that injustice is and really feel it, really understand emotionally what victims of injustice are going through, then we're going to be unlikely to try to do anything about that injustice, right? Or at least that's what I think a lot of these thinkers who advocate for spectatorial resentment tell us. So I start the book actually with a vignette from the civil rights movement with Martin Luther King and him writing to John F. Kennedy to sort of plea for the publication of a second Emancipation Proclamation that shows that Kennedy and the administration understands the justified anger and resentment of Blacks across the South who had suffered through Jim Crow for the last 100 years, who had been subject to police violence, to violence from their neighbors and fellow citizens with impunity effectively since the beginning of the Republic. But let's say, obviously, they're trying to say we should be full citizens according to the law, and we aren't. And it isn't enough to just have the formal legal recognition of our status as citizens, but we really need you to show that you feel and adopt our resentments, right? The fact that we have been wronged, that we are actual victims of injury. And famously, in a speech that he gives after the Birmingham campaign, Kennedy does exactly this, right? Tries to use the language of resentment and adopting emotions of other people, that is especially, I think, powerful after a lot of the images from the Birmingham campaign and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference's other campaigns throughout the South, and the violence that was used against these nonviolent protests, that's exactly what the rest of the country, right, is grappling with, that they feel these emotions of indignation and resentment on behalf of Black citizens in the South, and they want something to be done about it. Right, perhaps for the first time, or they want at least something. They don't like to see these images that they do. Right, so I think if we assume that resentment has violent effects, or that it always leads to irrational or disproportionate consequences, then we miss the potential for actual restitution, rectification of wrongs, and real justice or reparations even to be made on behalf of victims of injury. And we miss something that Amiya Srinivasan has written a lot about, which is affective injustice and the affective injustice of not allowing victims of injury to be heard. So one really wonderful facet of spectatorial resentment is that it is, like the title of the book suggests, it is recognizing the resentment of victims of injury. And that in itself is an important kind of duty, you might say, of liberal citizens, that it's not simply that we should prevent injustice, although that is a primary duty, but it's also that victims of injury and historical injustice have a right to be heard, and that spectatorial resentment really allows that to happen, really focuses on curing the concerns of victims of injustice and trying to deliberate about them, trying to adopt them.
And one of my students this past spring wrote her capstone on truth commissions, which is, you know, exactly what you're talking about, is the commission doesn't necessarily have a role in making policy, but it does have this role, as you note, in actually hearing the suffering of the victim, hearing the injury that the person or people experienced, so that is a form of justice, and possibly leading, as they're often known, truth and reconciliation commissions, so leading in the next direction. But you noted also that it's not a completely positive ending. And so I would love not to spoil anything, so people should definitely buy the book. But what is it that, again, is not solved by spectatorial resentment?
Yeah, I think the problems really that kind of plague the possibility for spectatorial resentment are just problems that maybe plague liberal society more broadly or contemporary liberal society more broadly. So what I talk about in the book is the ways that essentially sympathy, this is one way you can think of it, is the ways that sympathy can be limited, and as a result that our capacity for sympathetic resentment or ideally spectatorial resentment can be limited. So one of those is growing economic inequality. Again, maybe interestingly for your listeners who are less familiar with Smith, he famously was against what he calls an early draft of The Wealth of Nations, oppressive economic inequality, which is really extreme economic inequality when you have such a chasm between the different social classes that they're unable to actually sympathize with one another. And because that's fundamentally how we are capable of becoming moral persons, of making moral judgments, for Smith, if you have that divergence and you have that lack of communication, then really what happens is you push the poor into obscurity and you sort of do them another injustice besides preventing them from having material well-being, right, or other sort of economic measures of flourishing. But fundamentally, you make them unable to be subjects of sympathy with other people, to sympathize with one another. And that can prevent, say, the rich or people who are more well-off in society from actually being able to adopt that resentment. So that's just to say, when you have a society that is so stratified and where there's such a deep divisions between classes that they might not be able to sympathize with one another, to identify with one another, then you really cut off the potential for sympathetic resentment, for spectatorial resentment, right? I think the other risk is this risk of allowing sympathetic resentment to not develop into spectatorial resentment, to just adopting the partial resentments of your tribe or your family or your race or your class or what have you, not going through the difficult task of actually trying to sympathize with diverse others, which Smith thinks you need to do to try to paint this picture of who an impartial observer is, but who nevertheless it really is difficult for us to identify with, or it's difficult for us to imagine what an impartial perspective would look like in certain circumstances. So I think really the keys to the limitations to spectatorial resentment really lie in the ways that sympathy is limited in liberal societies.
And on that happy note, what are you working on now, Michelle?
Well, probably because I got so interested in Sklar's view of liberalism as I was working on this book, I am now starting to work a little bit more on a project on her view of liberalism, which is very in vogue right now, I think, because of our particular political moment, the rise of authoritarianism, the sort of realistic view that people want to have for politics, and also, you know, the continuing debate about whether liberalism still has any relevance, or whether we're able to save it from itself, whether it's worth saving. That kind of conversation, I think, that we're having not only in political theory but in political science and in popular discourse more broadly. And I think Sklar has a lot to say about how we can have a grounded liberalism, again, that is interested in minimizing, or sort of not, to use Berlin's distinction, not quite a negative conception of justice, but one that really is interested in the quite difficult task of minimizing cruelty, because human beings are so... it's so easy to be cruel to people who we determine are different than us in any way or another. And it's so difficult to uphold liberal principles against that. So I think there, like a lot of a lot of political theorists who are turning to her, I think there's really something worth finding and worth defending that Sklar helps explain.
Well, I look forward to that book and talking to you about it on the New Books Network when it comes out. And I would love to thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network to talk about Recognizing Resentment, Sympathy, Injustice, and Liberal Political Thought, published in 2020 by Cambridge University Press. Michelle, is there a brick and mortar store with an online presence that you would like to give a shout out to?
Oh yeah, there's a great brick and mortar store here in Madison called A Room of One's Own, independent bookstore here that has an online presence you can order the book from.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me today, Michelle Schwarza, and it's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Lily.